Allison?
Yes, Max?
Welcome to the very last episode of Season 2 of The Bitchery of History.
Oh, I'm having so many emotions.
I know, me too.
I'm sad, I'm happy, I'm excited. We have a live show coming up.
Live episode, a new podcast, new merchandise, a new team, a new logo's coming. Girl, so much is in store for Season 3.
It's like the third wave of feminism.
Oh my God.
What?
So excited. So where can people find us in the meantime?
Well, you can always keep in touch with us on Instagram at The Bitchery of History, Twitter at Bitchery Podcast. You can just search The Bitchery of History on Facebook. And we're always on patreon.com/UrsulaMajor. And if you really just need more stickers, umpboh.com.
Yes, ma'am.
Hello.
Hi, everyone. And welcome to
The Bitchery of History.
My name's Max.
And I'm Allison.
And this week, I'm talking about Patsy Takamoto Mink. I'm so excited.
I am going to be talking about Delphine Lalaurie. I am also so excited.
Oh my gosh.
And a little bit creeped out.
Yeah.
So here is the story.
Mm-hmm.
Born Marie Delphine McCarty in 1780, she was one of five children. Her family was very prominent in Louisiana. Her uncle was actually governor of the Spanish American provinces of Louisiana from 1785 to 1791. And her cousin was mayor of New Orleans from 1815 to 1820. So she marries her first husband, Don Ramon de Lopez y Angelo, on June 11th, 1800. Now, at some point, 4 years later, the two traveled to Spain for some disputed reason,
mm-hmm.
and he died on the ship on the way there. But she gave birth on the ship, too, to a daughter, who she named Marie Bourgeois Delphine Lopez y Angelo de la Candelaria, or they just called her Borquita. So,
okay. Keep
it short.
All right.
Keep it simple.
Sure.
Now, in June of 1808, she marries her second husband, Jean Blanc, a prominent banker, merchant, lawyer, and legislator, had four more children with him before he died in 1816. Just a
Mm-hmm.
She marries her third husband, physician Leonard Louis Nicholas Lalaurie, on June 25th, 1825.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in 1831, she buys some property at 1140 Royal Street in New Orleans, which she managed essentially on her own. In 1832, she then builds a two-story mansion with slave quarters there and lived there with her third husband and two of her daughters. She maintained and held a central position in New Orleans society. Now, I'm going to try and tell this story as our tour guide told it.
Okay.
Because I went and saw this house
in
the French Quarter of New Orleans and did a fantastic tour. So one of the stories and the first story that he told us of the goings-on at the Lalaurie Mansion is that a 12-year-old girl, a 12-year-old slave girl named Lee, fell to her death from the roof of the mansion. Apparently, she jumped to avoid punishment from Delphine, who was chasing her around with a whip because Lee had been brushing her hair and caught a snag accidentally yanking her head back.
Oh my God.
So this 12-year-old girl's body was buried on the mansion's grounds, and this incident led to an investigation, and Lalaurie was forced to forfeit 9 slaves, but one of her relatives just bought them and brought them all back to her. Now, what Delphine Lalaurie is most famous for, or infamous for, should we say, is her horrid and torturous treatment of slaves. Now, this story, of course, is probably spun a little bit out of control.
Right.
It's fantastical and, you know, if it bleeds, it leads kind of a thing.
Right.
But she was having a party in 1834 and a fire started in the house. And everyone was saying, we have to leave. There's a fire. And she's like, no, it's fine. It's fine. It's fine. And they said, no, there's a fire. We're going to go take the party outside. So they're all just partying outside while this fire's going on. Now, she was just going back and forth from the house attempting to save her valuables, but she was doing it on her own because the fire's spreading without any help from her slaves, which the neighbors found kind of odd. Now, others were reporting that they could hear screams coming from the attic. When the police and fire marshals arrived at the house, they discovered that the fire had been started in the kitchen by Delphine's 70-year-old cook, who was chained to the stove and starving. She told them it was a suicide attempt for fear of a worse punishment of being taken to the attic. She said that anyone who was taken there never came back.
Oh my.
The New Orleans Bee reported that bystanders who came to the aid of the family attempted to enter the slave quarters to ensure everyone had been evacuated, but it was locked and the Lollaries refused to give them the key. They decided to break down the door and found, quote, seven slaves, more or less horribly mutilated, suspended by the neck with their limbs stretched and torn from one extremity to the other, end quote. Despite being in terrible condition, they were still alive and told those who had broken in that they had been imprisoned for months.
Oh my God.
One of the bystanders who entered the premises was Judge Jean-Francois Cognon. And upon seeing the conditions of the slaves, he asked Madame Lollaries' husband what had happened and was told that, quote, some people had better stay at home rather than come to others' houses to dictate laws and meddle with other people's business.
He's literally a judge.
So after these stories circulated, a mob of local citizens attacked the Lollaries residence and destroyed everything in sight.
Wow.
When the police finally arrived and broke up the mob, the Royal Street property had barely anything left but the walls. Lollaries allegedly escaped to Paris, but their butler was left behind and he was killed by the mob. So despite everyone being so upset about the Lollaries' treatment of slaves, the remaining tortured slaves were taken to a local jail where they were available for public viewing.
Jesus Christ.
The New Orleans Bee reported that up to 4,000 people came and saw the tortured slaves to convince themselves that the stories were true of these sufferings. A report from the Pittsfield Sun claimed that two of the slaves that were found had died since the rescue and added, quote, we understand that in digging in the yard, bodies have been disinterred and the condemned well having been uncovered, others, particularly that of a child, were found, end quote. So probably that 12-year-old girl.
Right.
It's not totally clear the circumstances of Delphine Lollaries' death. One popular but unsubstantiated story claims that she died in France in a boar hunting accident. Whatever the case, in the late 1930s, a man named Eugene Backers, who served as a sexton to the St. Louis Cemetery, number one in New Orleans, discovered an old copper plate in the cemetery that reads, Madame Lollaries, née Marie Delphine McCarthy, décide à Paris le décembre 1842. So maybe she died then. Now, Harriet Martineau, a British writer and the first female sociologist, traveled to Louisiana after the infamous Lollaries fire in 1863. She wanted to learn more about what happened for her book. And 2 years after her visit, she wrote that New Orleans residents claimed the Lollaries slaves were observed to be singularly haggard and wretched. She also reported that Delphine beat her own daughters when they attempted to feed the slaves.
Wow. Jesus Christ.
So the story of Delphine Lollaries was quickly turned into folklore. George Washington Cable and Henry Castellanos both published stories about her, mostly based off reportings found in local newspapers after the fire and Martineau's book. Then more grotesque versions of the story came out in the 20th century, such as Ghost Story of Old New Orleans and Journey into Darkness, Ghosts and Vampires of New Orleans. And there are more detailed accounts, which are frequently passed on and recreated. Then, of course, season 3 of American Horror Story is all based in the house. Now, here's the thing.
Played
her house
by Kathy Bates.
Yeah, her house is still standing in New Orleans, and you can go and you can see it, and apparently you can take tours there. We just toured the French Quarter in general.
Right.
Not the house itself. But here are some things, okay? Nicolas Cage bought the house, because it keeps changing owners because it's haunted, right?
Right.
So people buy it and then they try and live in it and they can't sleep there. They can't spend the night there.
No.
So Nicolas Cage bought the house at one point and was like, it's fine. I'm Nicolas Cage. I'll live here with my family. It's good. I forget how long he waited or how long it took, but he eventually just bought a condo across the street. So every night his whole family would cross the street and go sleep in the condo be in this house.
Right.
Then the production company for American Horror Story went and looked at actually just filming in the house and bringing all the equipment in and shooting it there. And they had their equipment in there a few days and then said, nope, absolutely not. We're not filming in here.
Because it was haunted.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
So
you could not pay me any amount of money to put a foot inside that house. Not
I do it in the daytime. I do a tour in the daytime.
I would never do
it. But I wouldn't go at night. I would not go at night.
You can tell me about it. Don't take pictures because you'll see little ghost people popping up on those pictures. And I'm not about it. I'm not doing it.
All right. But yeah, that's Delphine Lalaurie. And once I heard the story and heard about her, I said I wanted to do her for the podcast. Because again, I think it's important to remember that women are not just saints. We are not just sluts. We are everything in between and below and above and all kinds of other things. And so it's important to remember that in all aspects of society and of history, even darker sides that we probably don't want to discuss, women have stories there too.
One of the very first quotes you said in the early seasons of season one is a quote that I tell literally everyone when I talk about the podcast. And it's a quote from The Love Song of J. Robert Oppenheimer, which is favorite play of all times.
Oh, it's beautiful.
And it says, "It does no use to put a woman on a pedestal. It is just another excuse not to look her in the eye."
Oh, I love that quote.
It's so good. It's the guiding quote for this podcast. Yes. And I love it so much.
Yes. All right, now on to happier times.
Oh my God.
Now tell me about Patsy.
Oh, here's Patsy. Okay. So Patsy was born in Hamakua Poko on the island of Maui on December 6, 1927. Mm. She was a third generation Japanese American, and her father was a civil engineer. Her mother was a homemaker. Mm. Her father was the first Japanese American to graduate from the University of Hawaii in 1922. Her father also worked in Maui as the only Japanese-American civil engineer. After facing discrimination, he actually resigned in 1945 after the aftermath of World War II.
Right.
And he established his own land surveying company in Honolulu.
Good for him.
She was 14 when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor.
Oh, Lord.
And Patsy and her family were actually really lucky that they were not taken away to internment camps. They escaped it. But her father was questioned, and he actually burned all of his Japanese mementos to quell any doubts that they weren't loyal to the United States.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
Patsy said of the situation, quote, "It made me realize that one could not take citizenship and the promise of the U.S. Constitution for granted."
Oof.
Take that to heart right now.
Too
please.
Real.
Patsy attended Maui High School, and her junior year, she won her first election to become student body president.
Aww.
The first girl ever to do so at that school.
Whoa.
The month before the election, there was an attack on Honolulu by Japan, adding to the growing sentiments all over the United States against Japanese Americans. Despite this, Patsy found ways to appeal to all the different cliques on campus and still won the election.
That's a politician.
When she graduated in 1944, she was the valedictorian.
Duh.
She then attended the University of Hawaii Medical School with the goal of having a career in medicine. Her sophomore year, she was elected president of the pre-medical students club and was elected as a member of the varsity debate team. She then traveled to the greater U.S. and attended Wilson College for one semester and then transferred to the University of Nebraska.
Hmm.
At that university, the University of Nebraska, they had a racial segregation policy where students of color lived in different dormitories from the white students. Patsy, annoyed by this policy, organized and created a coalition of students, parents, administrators, employees, alumni, sponsoring businesses, and corporations to oppose the policy.
Whoa, talk about extra credit.
She was elected president of the Unaffiliated Students of the University of Nebraska, a separate student government for the non-white students. And with her coalition, she successfully lobbied to end the university's segregation policy in the 1 year that she went to school there.
That only took her a year?
It took her a year.
Why can't she be president? I mean, I know she's passed away now, but dang, girl.
Just wait.
Chisholm and Mink. Let's get it done. Oh, my God. Alternate histories I would love to see. Okay, go on.
After defeating the segregation policy at the University of Nebraska, Patsy developed a serious thyroid condition, unfortunately, that actually required her to move back to Honolulu for surgery. She finished her final year of college at the University of Hawaii, earning her bachelor's degrees in zoology and chemistry.
All right.
However, none of the 20 medical schools she applied to after graduation would accept her because she was a woman.
I thought you were going to say Japanese American, but it's just because she's a woman?
Literally just because she's a woman.
That is a plate of cheese and crackers on a plate of beef. That is my new curse word that's safe for podcasts. Cheese and crackers on a plate of beef.
So.
Get your stew together, America. All I can't handle this. I can't.
So she decided that the best way to change this and to force the medical schools to accept women would be through the judicial process. So she went to law school.
Oh, hell yes!
She attended the University of Chicago Law School, which has admitted women from its inception. Ugh. And she obtained her Juris Doctor degree in 1951. She was one of two women in her classes. While at law school, Patsy met hydrologist John Mink, and they soon married. She was unable to find work, of course, as a female Asian American attorney in Chicago, and after giving birth to her daughter Gwendolyn in 1952, the family moved back to Hawaii. Hmm. In Hawaii, Patsy discovered that she had lost her residency status because her husband was from Pennsylvania, so she was technically now a resident there. In order to start practicing law, she would have to reestablish her Hawaiian residency. Patsy, rightfully, called out this law as sexist and challenged it. Hawaii's attorney general agreed with her and ruled that since she had never physically lived in Pennsylvania, she didn't assume her husband's status as a resident and could keep her Hawaiian residency. Patsy passed the bar exam in June 1953, but continued to face gender discrimination trying to find work. So with the help of her father, she created her own practice, making her the first Japanese American woman to practice law in Hawaii. During this time, she also founded the Everyman Organization, a group that served as the hub for the Young Democrats Club on Oahu. She was also elected chairman of the territory-wide Young Democrats. In 1954, she helped to elect John A. Burns to Congress, and the following year, she worked as a staff attorney during the 1955 Legislative Assembly. At this point, Hawaii was not yet officially a U.S. state. And as it debated whether it would receive statehood in 1956, mm-hmm. Patsy was elected to the Hawaii Territorial Legislature, representing her district in the Territorial House of Representatives.
Wow.
In 1958, she was elected to serve on the Territorial Senate. And in 1959, Hawaii became the 50th state of the Union. And Patsy served in the Hawaii State Senate from 1962 to 1964. She attended the 1960 Democratic National Convention and gave a passionate speech to the party that persuaded two-thirds of them to keep their progressive stance on civil rights. Literally one of my most favorite quotes of all time. You ready for this?
I'm ready.
If to believe in freedom and equality is to be a radical, then I am a radical. So long as there remain groups of our fellow Americans who are denied equal opportunity and equal protection under the law, we must remain steadfast. Till all the shades of man may stand side by side in dignity and self-respect to truly enjoy the fruits of this great land.
Oh, I have chills.
In 1965, Patsy Takamoto Mink became the first Asian American woman and the first woman of any ethnic minority to be elected to the United States Congress.
Oh, amazing.
She served six consecutive terms.
Yeah, she did.
She ran after reapportionment created a second seat in Hawaii, mm-hmm. and she mounted a grassroots campaign that relied on the staff of unpaid volunteers and her husband John serving as her campaign manager. Mm-hmm. She also ran without the blessing of the state Democratic Party leadership, raising her campaign funds largely in small individual contributions, probably in increments of $27. Immediately after being sworn into Congress, she was at the forefront of the effort to challenge the seating of an all-white Mississippi congregational delegation and postpone their swearing in until the 1964 elections could be investigated. They were being contested as unconstitutional because of widespread voter discrimination, intimidation, and violence against African-American voters. The effort was ultimately unsuccessful, and Patsy was in direct contact with Martin Luther King Jr. about what her and other congresspeople could do in order to support efforts in the future. She took what she learned in high school and college and built some of the most influential coalitions in Congress. Her most important coalition was one to support the Title IX Amendment of the Higher Education Act in 1972, of which she was one of the principal authors and sponsors. Title IX, of course, prohibits gender discrimination by federally funded institutions. Remember how she said she would find a way to force medical mm-hmm. schools to accept?
Mm-hmm.
She did it. She got Title IX passed.
Amazing. Oh, you won't accept me to medical school? That's fine. I'll just run for Congress. It's all Gucci. It's all Gucci in the house.
Title IX. Okay, to show the effect of the bill. Okay. If you're not sold on Title IX, in 1971 to 1972, before it was passed, only 9% of law school students were women. In 2011 and 2012, almost half were.
Wow.
In 1971 and 1972, 7% of girls participated in high school sports. By 2010 to 2011, it was 41%.
Amazing.
In 1970, she became the first Democratic woman to deliver a State of the Union response.
Whoa.
She was an early and outspoken opponent of the Vietnam War. And in fact, as an activist and anti-Vietnam War group in Oregon, put her on the ballot for president for the election in 1972, which technically makes her the first Asian American woman to ever run for president. But she only got 5,000 votes.
Does it also make her the first Asian American? I'm curious. Probably worth a Google.
Yeah, probably worth a Google. So in 1976, she decided to give up her seat in Congress to run for a vacancy in the Senate. But unfortunately, she lost to a man named Spark Matsunaga. After her Senate loss, President Jimmy Carter appointed Patsy as Assistant Secretary of State for Oceans and International Environmental and Scientific Affairs. She served under Secretary of State's Cyrus Vance and Edmund Muskie.
Well, excuse me.
Right? After her service in the Carter administration, she returned to Honolulu and was elected to the Honolulu City Council, eventually being elected as its chairwoman. She often butted heads with the mayor, Frank Fassi, who was a Republican. In 1990, she was re-elected to Congress as a representative of Hawaii and held this position until her death. On August 30th, 2002, Patsy was hospitalized in Honolulu's Straub Clinic and Hospital with complications from chickenpox.
Oh.
On September 28th, 2002, she died of viral pneumonia at the age of 74. Upon her death, President George W. Bush ordered all flags to be lowered to half staff in her honor.
Wow.
She received a national memorial and was honored with a state funeral in the Hawaii State Capitol Rotunda, attended by leaders and members of Congress. In 2003, the Patsy Takamoto Mink Education Foundation was founded. Its aim is to carry on Patsy's most ardent commitments, educational access, opportunity, and equity for low-income women, especially mothers, and educational enrichment for children.
Mm.
So listen to this. Her death occurred 1 week before the 2002 primary election.
Mm.
Too late for her name to be removed from the general election ballot. And so on November 5th, 2002, she was posthumously re-elected to Congress, and her seat was filled in a special election in January of 2003.
Oh.
On November 24th, 2014, she received a posthumous Medal of Freedom from President Barack Obama. There are two documentary films that have been made about her life, Rise of Waheen, directed by Dean Kaneshiro, and Patsy Mink, Ahead of the Majority, directed by Kimberly Bassford. She wrote a chapter in the book Yellow Girls, which is about the experiences of Asian teenage girls in American society. And she discusses her early political work in post-World War II America.
Mm.
Her daughter, Gwendolyn Mink, is a former professor of politics at the University of Southern California, Santa Cruz, who writes on law, poverty, policy, and gender issues.
What a life.
What an amazing life.
Oh, that was fantastic.
I love that we ended season two by talking about two extremes.
Yeah.
Which I think is really something that we've striven very hard to do on this podcast. And we talked about that after Delphine.
Yeah.
That we're going to show every aspect of womanhood on this podcast.
Yeah. The Bitchery of History is brought to you by Audible.com.
You can download a free book and start a free trial by going to audibletrial.com/bitchery.
This week, I'm going to recommend The Historian by Elizabeth Kostova. Have you read it?
I have not.
Have you read it? It's good, right? Kelsey's here.
Kelsey's sitting on the couch.
And yeah, it's quite good. It's a vampire book, but way better than Twilight. It's kind of a modern retake on Dracula.
Oh my.
So enjoy. There's some code breaking, historical investigations, all the kinds of things that we need to do.
Fantastic. So you can get that at
audibletrial.com/bitchery.
Hey friends, if you've enjoyed season two of The Bitchery of History, and if you've enjoyed this episode, do Allison and myself a favor and the rest of the team here at The Bitchery of History and give us a rating or a review. Because honestly, it goes such a long way to helping other people find the podcast, which of course helps us keep doing the podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.
Today in history.
On August 28th, 1913, Queen Wilhelmina opens the Peace Palace in The Hague, which houses the International Court of Justice.
Yes. And then on August 30th, 1918, Fanny Kaplan shoots and seriously injures Bolshevik leader Vladimir Lenin. When Kaplan refused to implicate anyone else in her plan, she was executed on September 3rd, 1918. This is one of the events which led to the decree for Red Terror.
And then on August 31st, 1869, Mary Ward, an Irish scientist, was killed when she fell under the wheels of an experimental steam car.
Oh, my.
So we've got to investigate that story.
Yes, we do.
What's our term of the week, Max?
Our term this week, and I thought it was fitting for our very last episode of season two, is why representation matters.
Are we going to talk about the video from Comic-Con?
Which one?
Of the little girl crying.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, with Gal Gadot.
I know. Oh. Are we going to talk about it? I thought yes, that's what we're, absolutely. You were meaning about.
Absolutely. So if you haven't seen it, we'll post this to the Facebook and to all the social medias. But there's this video of this little girl decked out as Wonder Woman meeting Gal Gadot, who played Wonder Woman, just crying her eyes out. And Gal literally holds up this line talking to this one girl, and it is so sweet.
Amazing.
It's literally a physical embodiment of why representation matters.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
So why do you think representation matters?
One, I mean, it's things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think is amazing, and they're so important. Growing up, Star Trek Voyager was a huge influence on me. It was the show that I watched.
Mm-hmm.
The most or as often as I could. I also watched Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. But watching that now as I'm older, it's still pretty strong female feminist show, but not as much as Voyager. Like, I always wanted to be Captain Janeway. It's always been my thing. And so growing up and seeing that it was possible for a woman to be respected and in charge.
Yeah,
there's nothing, absolutely. There's no explanation needed. It meant everything to me. You know, it showed me that I could be the leader and I could be the person that was in charge, and it didn't matter
yeah.
that I was a girl, and I didn't have to be afraid of saying, okay, people, let me help. Let me make this happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's taken me a while, I think, to come back to that realization and be comfortable saying, you know what, I can be the leader in this situation, and I can make sure that these things are happening, and I can be that person in charge and overseeing these projects or these events or whatever the case mm-hmm. may be. So that's one thing. And then I also remember hearing, and I don't remember the actual numbers of the statistics, but after The Hunger Games came out and after Brave came out, the participation for young girls and young mm-hmm. teens in archery went way up.
Whoa, I didn't hear about that.
I'll try and find the
it's
exact
not, I
numbers.
Believe you, absolutely.
But yeah, I mean, so it's just things like that. It's if she can see it, she can be it.
Absolutely.
And if you see it, then you know.
Yeah.
Whether you be an archer, you can be the captain of a starship, be you anything
know,
you want.
I would say that, you know, as a proud gay man, until I got into college, and really, honestly, I will say a lot of it has to do with Glee and Glee coming mm-hmm. out, I did not have language for what it was for a man to like another man. It just was not something that I was made aware of until I got to the end of high school and then coming into college, which is literally when Glee came out.
Right.
Watching Blaine and Kurt kiss on Glee was mind-blowing for me.
Yeah.
Because it was the first time I had ever seen that happen.
Yeah.
Now, I had gone to camp and I knew lesbian rabbis at camp, and mm-hmm. I knew that being gay was a thing, but I didn't have representation for that outside of, you know, my Jewish culture, my Jewish Reconstructionist culture. So it was the creation of a TV show, Glee, that really helped me to kind of see that in the real world, to see that it was something that could actually happen out in the world. And I think it gets kind of easy to think, oh, well, I know about it, so everyone must know about it.
Hmm.
And it's such a dangerous trap to fall into. And I have really tried to kind of, it's one of the reasons that we created the podcast, is because, you know, we know about it, and so we should show the world about it. Because there's going to be someone who doesn't know these stories. There's going to be someone who doesn't know everything, who hasn't had the privilege of the education mm-hmm. or the privilege of the life experience that you've had. And so it's almost imperative that you kind of help to spread knowledge.
Yeah. think stories are important.
Representation is everything.
They've got to be shared. Absolutely. I agree.
Absolutely.
It's a beautiful thought.
Octavia Butler, who we did a couple weeks ago, and we talked about her when we did the story. It's, you know, she said, you know, I never saw black people in writing. It was always, they always turned the black people into aliens. And literally, yeah. Octavia Butler was told by a man on a panel, why do you need people of color? You can just do it with aliens.
Oh, Lord.
Representation matters. Absolutely. All right.
What's our cause this week, Max?
Our cause this week is the Patsy Takamoto Mink Education Foundation for low-income women and children. You can find them at patsyminkfoundation.org.
It was established in 2003. The Patsy Takamoto Mink Education Foundation aims to carry on some of Mink's most ardent commitments: educational access, opportunity, and equity for low-income women, especially mothers, and educational enrichment for children. In 2017, the foundation will offer 5 education support awards of up to $5,000 each to assist low-income women with children who are pursuing post-secondary education. So that's going to be announced in October, the awardees of that.
Fantastic.
So if you think that you are eligible and you want to apply, you can find that at patsymingfoundation.org. Or if you just want to donate to the foundation and help them award more grants in the coming years, patsymingfoundation.org.
Awesome. All right. For the last time in season 2, The Bitchery of History is a production of Ursula Major Productions. You can find us on Twitter at Bitchery Podcast, on Instagram at The Bitchery of History, and on Facebook, just search The Bitchery of History. You'll find us, I promise.
And if you need stickers while we're gone, umpboh.com. And we'll keep the Patreon updated with all those bloopers and behind-the-scene things you love. Patreon.com/UrsulaMajor.
As always, we are so grateful for our team here at The Bitchery of History. And that includes Kim.
Steph.
Jeanette.
Dan.
Keegan.
Jess.
And Sydney.
Did we get everyone?
I believe so.
Thank you, guys. For real, it's been an amazing season 2. We will see you in season 3.
And also, let me just end by saying thank you, Allison.
Thank you, Max. This has been great.
It has.
I love it. Mm-hmm. Let's do it again next year.
Oh, my God. Let's do it.
Let's do it live on September 24th.
And as always,
bitches get stuff done.